News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us?
Today is Friday, April 6th. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Nina Kurgia. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to our listeners of the podcast and newscast on our website at citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5:10 p.m. and time for another almost full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. We will also be talking to Dr. Paul Evans, director of the Institute of Asian Research, about the BC government's commitment of $700 million to transportation projects to improve trade with Asia. As well, we will be talking to Professor Bowman from UBC's Department of Botany and Forest Sciences about an exciting new discovery.
All this, plus your weekend weather forecast, right here on News 101, your source for independent news.
And now for your UBC campus news.
AMS security workers could potentially hold a strike as early as Tuesday. A mediator has been leading negotiations between the AMS and COPE 378, the security workers union, since March 16th, a day after the union gave a 72-hour strike notice. The mediator was brought in when the AMS invoked a rule that requires both parties to go through mediation before a strike or lockout can occur. But wages became a sticking point in negotiations, leading the mediator to clear the way for job actions. AMS President Matt Parson said, quote, "Is the mediator's opinion that we're so far apart on what we think is fair that just through mediation we wouldn't be able to come to a first collective agreement." The Labor Relations, end quote. The Labor Relations Board will, after it hears from both the AMS and the union, decide to either get an arbitrator to force both parties to accept an agreement or allow for a strike or lockout. AMS Council has approved giving the executive power to lockout security workers, but Parson says they are waiting before deciding how to respond to the ruling.
On a similar note, UBC's TA union is holding workshops to train picket captains as preparations increase for a possible call to strike over the long weekend. While no strike has been called, CUP 2278, the union that represents UBC's TAs, posted on their blog that they would hold workshops for picketing on April 4th and 5th. The blog post said, quote, "These workshops will be about how to run a picket, scheduling, and the legal requirements involved in successful job action," end quote. Should a strike get called over the weekend, the repercussions could be felt as early as Tuesday, as only 72 hours' notice are required. Last week, Public Affairs Director Lucy McNeil said that contingency plans for invigilating and marking exams would be done on a faculty-by-faculty basis. McNeil added that if picket lines aren't set up, the strike itself wouldn't theoretically stop people from going in to supervise or take an exam. Further complications could arise from students who commute if TransLink follows suit with refusing to cross picket lines, as they did with the 2003 TA strike when buses turned around at Blanca Street. However, Gavin Davies, VP of the Canadian Auto Workers Local 111, which represents TransLink, clarified that the transit workers would not likely be affected if the picket lines were at buildings around campus and avoided the bus loop.
And now for our interview with Dr. Paul Evans, Director of the Institute of Asian Research.
So we've got Dr. Evans on the air with us today to talk about the recent announcement by the BC government to put $700 million into funding for transportation and infrastructure development meant to help ties with Asia. So Dr. Evans, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be with you.
So we know that your strong suit is Asia, and so given that this recent investment has been made, what sort of short-term effect do you see that having?
Well, I think the short-term effect is really just sustaining and building on a process that's been underway since 2005. At that stage, the federal government and the provincial government decided to focus more resources on our infrastructure capacity for expanding trade and moving containers and bulk goods across the Pacific. And this investment by Ms. Clark, this announcement of her investment, is really about just the most recent phase of something that's probably going to be a 20-year process, and we're now in about year 10.
And I know that I'd noticed somewhere that there had been a prediction made that the BC government would have to put a lot more into funding transportation infrastructure in order to really sustain the relationship that they have right now and fund a lot more into that if they want to see this growing by 2020. Do you think that's true? Do you think they're doing enough right now, or is this the first step in the right direction?
It's the infrastructure game linking the Pacific on different sides, whether it's in Asia or on the North American side. This is a big dollars game, and the $25 to $50 billion that is being considered in Canada over that period of time is about what the Chinese government is putting into this per year. Mm-hmm. So that the scale of it, while it looks large to us in the context of what's going on around the rim, is not that large. But it is significant what the Clark government is doing, is trying to lever and use a fairly small amount of public money. I think she announced $700 million earlier this week, mm-hmm. but tied to more than 10 times that amount in investment from private sector right. and from the federal government. So what Ms. Clark is trying to do is put together these partnerships that involve the government and the private sector, two levels of government and the private sector, to lever some of her money.
Mm-hmm. So there haven't been any specific projects announced yet, but what would you say is probably what she's wanting to do with that?
Well, my guess is the provincial government has put out a plan for what it would like to see accomplished over the next decade, and it is this is not more money for the Portman Bridge and the South Fraser Perimeter Road. It's very likely to be in the port facilities and rail connections, mm-hmm. And that will be largely for the export of goods to Asia. I think that one of the things we need to look at when we're looking at all of these investments is infrastructure enough? It's certainly necessary, but to be effective in Asia is not just being able to move goods back and forth quickly. It's also ideas, innovation, and value added. And so I think that as the gateway goes forward, one of the big challenges is going to be moving beyond physical infrastructure. Mm-hmm. It's ideas, it's people that really matter. What passes through a gateway is not nearly as important as what happens inside a gateway to bring value added, and that means technology, that means research, and it means new human connections.
Well, speaking of gateway, does the gateway pipeline come into any of this in terms of the project? Because I don't know if that's a specific another issue that she's conquering, but is this tied in?
The provincial government, unlike the federal government, but the provincial government has not yet committed to the Northern Gateway project for the pipeline to bring bitumen or heavy oil from Alberta for export across or down the Pacific. So the provincial government hasn't linked it. What is complicated for Canadians and for British Columbians is we know that Mr. Harper's government, the federal government, has. When Mr. Harper was in China last month, he took with him the president of Enbridge Pipeline. Mm-hmm. But the provincial government is much more careful. And in fact, in some ways, they're trying to distance themselves from the federal government without saying no to the pipeline. They're just not saying yes at this point. I think it's the most controversial aspect of gateway strategies and gateway thinking, whether energy exports should be a part of it. And we're seeing in this province that there is strong resistance to it in some quarters, and it may well emerge as the most important election issue the next time there's a federal election, and it may show up in our provincial election coming up next year.
That'll be interesting to see that play out, because, I mean, the provincial and the federal should be usually agreeing or trying to agree, so it'll be interesting to see how that works out, because, well, what do you think can happen with that? Because I don't think that's normal for them to be opposing. Do you know what I mean?
That's true. The Liberal government here in BC has generally, under both Mr. Campbell and Ms. Campbell and Ms. Clark, has worked very closely with the federal government on infrastructure projects. But energy is a different domain, and the partnership that BC has had with the federal government, the partnership BC has had with Alberta on the rails and the roads and the port infrastructure, that's not yet replicated, that's not yet the same in the energy sector. And it'll be, for obvious reasons, the pressures in British Columbia, in northern BC with First Nations groups, on the campus here, whatever the benefits of energy exports, there's a lot of resistance to the pipeline. So the provincial government is being very careful now, recognizing that this could be a decisive issue come next year's election here in the province. And it may well become, at the federal level, the biggest election issue we've faced around a pipeline since 1956.
Yeah, definitely it will be interesting to see where that goes, because it's true there's so much opposition here, and then federally it's definitely a different story. I guess just in terms of this investment by the government, you'd spoken about it not necessarily being the presence of a pipeline, but the people in a pipe, or in a gateway rather, that make the difference. Do you think that Vancouver will continue in its role as such an important gateway to the east? Like, do you think this this investment will help to ensure that Vancouver and BC stays a major player in this?
It's absolutely essential to have the physical infrastructure for connecting to Asia, both for imports and exports, and for moving people back and forth. But I think, as we've seen with Singapore, as we've seen with Hong Kong, as we're now even seeing with mainland Chinese cities, simply to move goods is only a small part of the game. There's all kinds of producers. There's all kinds of goods. And to simply be the mover of containers is to be the 21st century equivalent of the hewer of wood and the drawer of water, just mm-hmm. a movement of a container. So how we upgrade the value added, how we use that gateway, the physical infrastructure, as Singapore does and Hong Kong does, to increase manufacturing, to increase innovation in research. Wood chips by themselves are an export, an extremely valuable export, can be new kind of biomass research that makes those wood chips more valuable. And if we start doing more processing here and less of it in Asia or in the United States, that's where the future of British Columbia really lies.
I think those ideas that you suggest there, they seem to be primarily on the private sector side of things. Are there any suggestions that you would have for the Clark government right now to continue building this gateway relationship?
I think the physical infrastructure things do need to continue, but it has to be put in the context of the human gateway and the ideas gateway. Vancouver is in many ways Canada's, or maybe even North America's, Pacific or Pacific Asian city. Mm-hmm. And I think that in the university world, it's fascinating that we don't have a single course at the University of British Columbia or at any major Canadian university on gateways. So that the kind of thinking we need for how we're going to use our educational resources, how we're going to gear up people to take advantage of these transportation systems, and how we think about Asia on the other side in more creative ways, That's a challenge not just for Ms. Clark's government or the federal government and business. It's a challenge for us in the universities, too.
Definitely.
So, sorry, when you said that it's not a physical thing exactly, I mean, because when I think of transportation, I'm thinking they're building roads, they're building railways. That, to me, that's a physical thing. Like, what did you mean by that?
Well, I think that it is the case that a gateway is usually about physical things. It's port infrastructure. It's what goes on at airports. You can kind of imagine in your mind men and women and their machines. But when we start getting into the levels of ideas, the communications gateways, it has to do with human resources, not just people moving back and forth, but ideas. And, for example, a good student exchange between University of British Columbia and some of the maritime universities in China on how you move a gateway from simply those goods to higher value production, how you move it to new technologies and new innovations. That's a kind of ideas gateway. If we imagine it in front of us, it's not hard infrastructure, it's thinking and it's communication. And that's, I think, the higher element of a gateway that the most successful ones in the world pursue.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely. Living beyond the physical.
Yeah, it was really interesting having you on. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to talk to us.
Well, I look forward to it and hope, again, we can talk on the energy dimension of this on another occasion.
Yes,
Clark doesn't want to put it all together. But those of us who live here know that the energy is the most controversial and in some ways the biggest issue that's going to be emerging out of Gateway on the national scene.
Definitely.
Yeah, definitely. Hopefully we can have you on soon to talk about that as well.
Thank you so much, Dr. Evans.
So looking forward to it.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So once again, that was Dr. Paul Evans from the Institute of Asian Research here at UBC, chatting with us a bit about the recent Clark government's investment in infrastructure for trade with China, and beyond that, the importance of Vancouver and BC as a gateway with Asia.
So we're going to take a quick break, we'll be right back with our local news.
Liveband.com is Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar. New shows are added daily by the city's most active promoters, musicians, and by the driving force of the music scene, the fans. Liveband.com's listings are different because they are integrated with profiles updated by bands and business owners as they promote upcoming events. Check out the archives to see how closely we've worked within the community to put on the shows you love. Visit LiveMusicVancouver.com for the latest independent and major label event listings. Liveband.com, Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
April and Discorder is here. Daffodils are blooming, cherry blossoms blossoming, and Discorder smells spring fresh off the presses. Check inside for monthly faves, The Overeducated Grumbler, on the topic of Dan Levy, getting textually active with rock stars, and news on the venues you know and love. Read up on the lovelies of Ruffled Feathers, Indigo Kids, and Dirty Spells, and figure out where to pick up hard copies of their stuff at your favorite local record store on Record Store Day. Reviews, calendars, charts, interviews, art projects, photos, write-ups, and teardowns, all that and more in your free April issue of Discorder. Pick up your beautiful and free copy of Discorder at any Friends of CITR business, or if you've gone paperless, don't forget to check out Discorder at discorder.ca. Discorder, that magazine from CITR, supporting local music for over 25 years.
Welcome back to CITR News 101, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building of University of British Columbia. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Nina Krigia. And here is your continuing campus news. The Norm Theatre will finally be upgrading their projector after 44 years of using a 35mm film. The UBC Film Society approached the AMS last year requesting an upgrade from their 35mm film projector. The AMS decided in February to commit $90,000 in funding a new digital projector. Evan
Gillespie,
operations manager at the Film Society, said, quote, "The Film Society projects all of our films with a 35mm projector, but it's been increasingly difficult to get 35mm prints. We need to go digital if we want to continue showing new movies. Also saying that $90,000 commitment was, quote, very cheap for a projector. We get a good deal, end quote. A new digital projector is just the beginning of the big changes in store for the norm. The theater space itself will undergo a physical transformation along with the new sub, which is set for completion in 2014. But the norm will stay in the old building. The theater also plans to upgrade its concession stand and lobby, and the area where the deli is currently located will be transformed into a new entrance to the theater. The norm, put together in 1965 and originally dubbed the Sub Auditorium, was part of the core vision of the Sub in the 1960s. I hope they also move the deli and don't get rid of it.
I'm sure they wouldn't. It's a campus icon. Yeah, it's interesting about the new Sub. We'll keep updated on that. But in more news about upgrades, UBC is planning to renovate the 6 original Totem residences, Dene, Haida, Kwakdal, Nootka, Salish, and Shuswap, over the next 3 years. Kwakdal and Shuswap will be targeted for the first round of renovations this summer, followed by Haida and Salish in 2013. Nootka and Dene will be the last pair renovated in 2014. The 6 buildings were originally built between 1964 and 1968 at a cost of $5.68 million. The renovation efforts come as a welcome change for Totem Park's residents, many of whom say they have suffered long enough with the 50-year-old infrastructure. While these improvements won't be a benefit to students currently living in Totem Park, it will make life in residence significantly better for those entering UBC over the next few years. Student Housing and Hospitality Services Managing Director Andrew Parr said that construction that might normally disrupt student life shouldn't be too much of a problem in this case, because construction won't begin until students depart after exams and is planned to be completed before their arrival in late August.
Arts philanthropist Michael Audane has gifted the UBC $5 million through his family foundation to establish a major new center for the visual arts at our university to provide, quote, a leading edge facility for future generations of Canadian artists, end quote. The donation will create the Audane Art Center, an important new facility for UBC's Department of Art History, Visual Art, and Theory. The department has fostered some of Canada's best-known visual artists, including Jeff Wall, Ken Lum, and Ian Wallace. The gift ties with the largest donation ever received by UBC's Faculty of Arts and follows Audane's recent donation to the UBC's Museum of Anthropology, valued at $1.2 million. The gift brings Audane's total donations to UBC to over $10 million, more than he has given to any other single institution. Expected to open in September 2013, the 2,600-square-meter Audane Art Center will span 4 stories in Ponderosa Commons, a new student housing and academic facility currently under construction on UBC's Vancouver campus.
And now just for a warning, Vancouver police are warning the public to be on the alert for James Patrick Benson, a high-risk sex offender who walked away from a halfway house in Vancouver last night. Benson has a criminal history dating back to the 1990s, and he's been convicted of sexual assault, attempted murder, and extortion, as well as weapons offenses and property crimes. Wanted on a Canada-wide warrant, Benson is described as white, 5'8", 200 pounds, with short brown hair and brown eyes. He is 32 years old. He has scars on his left forearm and left calf, and several tattoos, including an inscription on his left forearm reading Morbid, one on his left upper chest reading Lost Soul, flames on his left thigh, tribal art on his upper right arm, and the numbers 01-17-07 on the inside of his left wrist. He also needs prescription lenses. This is not the first time Benson has disappeared. He breached his conditions in February 2011 as well, and was found a week later at a friend's house on the Sunshine Coast. Anyone with information is warned not to approach him, but to call 911 immediately.
So be careful when you are going out tonight. Do not walk home alone. Anyway, those are your UBC campus and local headlines on News 101. We're going to move to provincial headlines now.
And a man has been killed while snowboarding on Blackcomb Mountain in Whistler, BC, police say. Police said a skier found the snowboarder at about 11 a.m. on Wednesday, head to toe in snow at the foot of a tree beside a ski run on the mountain called Seventh Heaven. RCMP Staff Sergeant Steve LeClaire said the man was unconscious and was not breathing, and those in the scene began CPR until paramedics arrived. The man was transported by helicopter to the Whistler Healthcare Center, where he was pronounced dead, LeClaire said. The BC Coroner Service is working with the RCMP to try to determine what happened. The man's identity has not yet been released. Sergeant LeClaire said that although the snowboarder was riding within the ski area boundary, the public must remember that natural hazards such as tree wells, open creeks, and other obstacles do exist in the ski area.
Several municipalities in British Columbia are raising the alarm over what they say are completely unexpected pay raises the federal government has mandated for the RCMP. The news has come as a shock to provincial and municipal officials who just signed a new 20-year contract with the National Police Force. That agreement, which is essentially identical to contracts reached in 5 other provinces and 3 territories, comes a year after BC threatened to pull out of negotiations altogether and set up its own force. The officials say the deal, signed only 2 weeks ago, was supposed to end a history of costly surprises and that there was no mention of pay raises during the negotiations. Langley Mayor Peter Fassbender said on Thursday that, quote, this was being done by the Treasury Board, which is where the pay council for the RCMP is housed, and it was part of the federal budget. So what's disappointing is that there was no heads up given by the Treasury Board to anybody, even in their own federal ministry, that this was going to be coming down, end quote. Mayor Fassbender said from what he understands, the Treasury Board's directive allows RCMP members to receive pay raises over each of the next three years, beginning immediately. Surrey Mayor Diane Watts, whose city is home to the largest RCMP detachment in the country, says she feels she's been blindsided by BC Justice Minister Shirley Bond and said she was caught off guard and has asked Ottawa for clarification.
Police call child welfare officials after finding young kids living in a Nelson area home with a large marijuana grow operation. On March 2nd, members of the RCMP Federal Border Integrity Program executed a search warrant on the rural residence and seized more than 5,200 marijuana plants. Two men, aged 40 and 44, and a 42-year-old woman were arrested in the home where officers found 2 young children living. Police say the children were exposed to dangers in the grow-op, such as chemicals, unsafe electrical wiring, and drugs. The Ministry of Child and Family Development was notified to attend and ensure proper care for the children, police say. The investigation is ongoing, and charges are pending after a report to Crown Counsel.
The British Columbia Teachers Federation has asked the Labour Relations Board to cancel the appointment of Charles Jago as mediator in the labour dispute with its employer. Education Minister George Abbott appointed Jago on March 28th to mediate between the BCTF and the BC Public Schools Employers Association under legislation he said was aimed at ending the dispute. The BCTF initially reacted to the appointment with concern and on April 2nd sent Jago a 3-page letter asking him to resign. The letter outlined the union's reasons, including Jago's lack of mediation experience, the bias expressed in views he included in a 2006 report on the education system, and his involvement in drafting the legislation under which he was appointed. Jago responded in a letter the next day saying he won't withdraw. He wrote, quote, I assure you that I am impartial. From the outset, I have been clear that I will be fair and balanced in mediating this dispute. I have committed to both you and the government that I will exercise my independence as mediator pursuant to the terms of Bill 22. End quote. The BCTF news release said the union, quote, remains unsatisfied that he could reasonably be viewed as impartial. End quote.
CBC Radio Canada will eliminate hundreds of jobs, cancel some programs, and boost ads as part of cost-cutting measures to cope with planned budget cuts outlined in the recent federal budget, the public broadcaster announced on Wednesday. The budget released last week said that the CBC will lose $115 million in funding over 3 years. But CBC President and CEO Hubert Tillacroix said that the unavoidable cost increase in investments mean that the corporation faces financial pressures of up to $200 million. Nicola said they hope to offset that with $50 million in new revenues, which will leave the CBC with about $150 million to account for by way of reductions in operating improvements. Christine Stewart, Executive Vice President, English Services, said $43 million worth of programming will have to be cut out of the English Services budget, meaning that some current shows in prime time will have to be cancelled and that viewers can expect more repeats. CBC Radio Canada will also accelerate the shutdown of analog television transmitters and lease and sell off real estate at the Broadcasting Centre in Toronto to raise funds. That's pretty grim news for us fellow media people here who hope to maybe one day find one of those rapidly disappearing jobs with the CBC.
Of course, and I just thought back to the George Stephanopoulos lecture when he said that what was so great about the CBC is that it is publicly funded, so there isn't a corporation behind it, and now that they don't have funding, and they're going to be having more advertisements and might lose that purpose. So we're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for your international news.
This April, Timber Concerts and CITR Radio are proud to present
Mike Doughty, April 5th at the Media Club. Doors are at 8 and the show begins at 9 p.m. The American singer-songwriter, formerly of Soul Coughing, is on tour performing a concert and conducting Q&As about his new book, The Book of Drugs.
Chairlift with special guest Night Jewel, Friday, April 6th at the Electric Owl. This will be an early show, ending at 11. All the way from Brooklyn, this electro-pop duo is on tour to support that new release, Something.
First Aid Kit with special guest Peggy Sue, Thursday, April 10th at Venue. Coming at you from Sweden, First Aid Kit is an indie folk duo touring to support their latest release, The Lion's Roar. For tickets, visit northerntickets.com or Red Cat High Life and Zulu Records. For more information, please visit tamberconcerts.com.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
There were once five boys who wanted to be robots. However, the powers that be forbade this, so they settled for being a band. That band is called Facts, and on Friday, April 13th, you can join them to celebrate the release of their new album, Like a Living Being. This album release party will feature guests Synthcake, Gang Signs, and WinnieCooper.net DJ Tristan Orchard. Visuals are provided by Leaf Hall, and if you're interested in pre-sale tickets, just visit WinnieCooper.net/tickets. Facts, Like a Living Being album release party, Friday, April 13th at the Waldorf Hotel, proudly sponsored by CITR.
Hellraiser 2. Time to play.
Hellraiser 2 by Any Means Necessary, a fundraiser coming to the local theater near you, Rio Theater, in support of all Vancouver independent venues. Saturday, April 14th from 8 p.m. till 1 in the morning. This is a hell-raising night of cabaret, theater, comedy, music, and dance. Hellraiser Nights are a series of fundraisers to help the Rio Theater survive the LCLB licensing hell. Hellraiser 2 is by donation and a 19-plus event. Come out and raise some hell, April 14th at the Rio Theater.
Welcome back to CITR News 101, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Nina Krigia.
And we're joined now over the phone by Professor Bowman, who's a professor here at UBC in Botany and Forest Sciences. And Professor Bowman's had a very interesting discovery recently regarding perfume and ambergris, so we're happy to have him on. Professor Bowman, welcome to the show.
Hello, Claire.
So first of all, could you just give us a bit of background into, I guess, the perfume industry with ambergris and what that is and what it is you were trying to do?
Okay, I can try, although I have to say I'm not in the perfume industry myself. I'm as you said, professor for plant biology at UBC in the Michael Smith Labs, Botany and Forestry. So I'm not really an expert in perfumes, but one or two things that I do know is that perfumes are probably best known for the many ingredients that they have that are of origin made from plants, like, let's say, fragrances that have rose-like notes or lavender or jasmine-like notes. And that's probably what most people associate with perfumes, flowery, fruity type of aromas, maybe earthy, maybe woody. So all sort of nice, natural. And I think very few people know that certain perfumes, and certainly more traditionally than now, also contain animal products like musk or gland extract or ambergris. And ambergris is something that is traditionally produced from what you would commonly refer to as whale bath. It's something that whales produce in their intestines. It's a greasy gemisch of compounds that they produce to protect their intestines from sharp objects that they take up with their food, be it shells or other sharp objects that get into their stomachs. And they put this greasy clump around this. And every once in a while, they have to get rid of these big clumps, and in essence, they throw it up. And then it goes into the ocean waters, where it reacts with oxygen and ocean water, and becomes somewhat hard, and it's still very, very light. It doesn't sink to the bottom of the ocean. It stays afloat. And eventually comes to the shores, and that's where it's being picked up. And sometimes someone figured out that there's a fragrance to this compound that's called ambergris, which indeed is whale bath, and that it can also be used in perfumes not only as a scent, but also as a so-called fixative. And that's why, in particular, in the high-value and high-end perfume, it's been an important ingredient traditionally, in that it retains the important fragrance notes for a longer time on your skin, as opposed to a cheap fragrance where the perfume evaporates very quickly, and after about 10 minutes or an hour or so, the fragrance is gone, so it doesn't last for the evening or the day. So that's why traditionally perfumers added ambergris, an animal byproduct made by sperm whales, to perfume as a fixative and as a scented compound. Now, for a long time already, there has been substitutes for ambergris in form of, for example, another product that's called Ambrox. And Ambrox has the same type of scented qualities and also acts as a fixative. But Ambrox is made from plant ingredients, specifically from components of the flowers of certain sage plants, specifically clary sage, which is grown and cultivated, for example, in the Mediterranean. And another compound that can be used for Ambrox production, again, as a substitute for the whale-produced ambergris, is ingredients from the oleoresin or pitch of fir trees, specifically a compound that's called cisabianol. The cisabianol can be used as a precursor to produce ambergris, and it can be used to produce Ambrox, and Ambrox can then be used in perfumes instead of the whale-produced ambergris.
So, Professor, a quick question. Why? I understand that sperm whales are endangered species, but why is the process of getting the ambergris controversial?
Well, it's controversial probably mostly because many people would probably think twice about a certain perfume if they knew that it had a compound in there that you may define as whale bath. I think most people would probably be more pleased if they thought that their perfumes were entirely based on plants and other type of natural products, but not animal products. So this is a bit where the marketing type of controversy comes in. But now, ambergris comes from sperm whales as an endangered species, but you don't need to hurt or harm or kill sperm whales to get the compound. Nevertheless, the price for ambergris is extremely high. Some companies pay several thousand dollars, up to $10,000 or $15,000 for a kilogram of ambergris. So there might be an added incentive to actually obtain ambergris, also as a byproduct from illegal harvest hunting of whales. So that may add another facet to the controversy. But I guess if you just would go on a bus today and ask someone if they would prefer to have the perfume made from something that comes out of the intestines of a whale or comes out of a field of sage flowers or out of the olive resin of a fir tree, I bet you would get more votes for the second and the third.
Absolutely, yes.
Now, these plant products also have the complications with them in that the plant doesn't produce a single compound, the one that is desirable for the perfume industry, but the plants typically produce complex mixtures of 10 or 100 of similar compounds, and there is the added difficulty then to extract the one that you want, the very specific one compound as opposed to the dozens of different compounds. And this is where our research has come in. We knew about balsam fir producing the particular compound of interest, and we were actually going after the biocatalyst that allows the fir tree to produce this compound. And in nature, any biocatalyst, which is also commonly referred to as an enzyme, is the product of a gene where the gene contains the information for producing this biocatalyst. The biocatalyst then goes to work and produces the compound of interest. So we were able to isolate from the fir tree the gene of interest that produces the relevant biocatalyst. And now that we have this biocatalyst in hand, we can use microbial production systems to produce the compound of interest, hopefully in the future, in a reproducible and high quality and high yield fashion. Somewhat similar like certain plant-based pharmaceuticals, like certain anti-malaria drugs, specifically artemisinin, and other interesting products from plants can be produced in yeast as a sustainable bioproduction system for so-called bioproducts.
So how did you guys come across using balsam fir? Like how did that come up? Was that already in the works, or how did that start? When, I mean, that's a big thing to move from whale barf to
well, the knowledge of the balsam fir component is quite old and is traditional knowledge that was available to us through contact with the industry. It's available to us also through the scientific knowledge. So this was nothing new, and I think this is just where chemists and perfumers have been working together for a long time to find substitutes for the whale compound. But again, what wasn't known is how the fir tree is able to produce these compounds. And then for us is us being able to perhaps produce more efficient and more specific biological production systems for these type of compounds.
And what do you think is the most, is it the money saving, or is it sustainability? What do you think is the most important aspect that will come out of this, of using the balsam fir?
First of all, this is a part of the fun part of my research. This is not the one where I look at making money, or I don't know if anyone would be able to make money off this. But well, the perfume industry might, if they can deliver a production system, a microbial production system. But it's really a fun component of our research, going out and exploring how nature produces interesting fragrances like the fir fragrance. Likewise, also we've been working on flower fragrances from snapdragon. We're working on grape wine fragrances and flavors that make it into the wine aroma. And then I was trying to find out how nature produces these compounds and if some of these compounds that are difficult to produce, both for chemists as well as difficult to produce for the plant itself, learning the tricks from the plant and transferring these tricks into microorganisms that can be used as production platforms that are safe, that are reliable, and really going into the stream of what we refer to as bioproducts. And these bioproducts is the big line of products that are being produced in biological systems, like yeast, for example, and fall into the same area of research as, for instance, biofuels and certain forms of bioenergy. Yeah.
And that's becoming a pretty big field.
That's a very big field, indeed. Yeah. And again, these perfumes and fine chemicals are just one facet of this very big field of bioenergy, biofuels, as well as bioproducts. And it's a certain niche area that's actually really fun to work in.
Wow. Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today, and we wish you luck with the rest of your research.
Thank you, Claire.
Great. Thank you. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
So that was Professor Jörg Bullmann from UBC's Department of Botany and Plant Sciences talking to us about an exciting new discovery that he's had, isolating a gene from balsam trees to produce something to replace ambergris, which is often used in perfume. So we now go to our international news.
11,541 red chairs, one for each civilian killed in Sarajevo during a nearly four-year war siege of the capital, are standing empty along the city's main avenue as Bosnia and Herzegovina commemorate the 20th anniversary of the start of the country's war. People gathered along Marshal Tito Avenue to attend the remembrance ceremony on Friday, where a choir accompanied by a small classical orchestra performed an arrangement of 14 songs, most of them composed during the bloody siege. People placed white roses on some of the chairs, while on the smaller seats, symbolizing hundreds of children killed, sat teddy bears, toys, and school books. The ceremonies took place exactly two decades after Bosnian Serb snipers opened fire on thousands of protesters, inflicting the first casualties of the war and triggering a conflict that tore apart the newly independent former Yugoslav Republic along ethnic lines. Earlier, Sarajevo residents stopped what they were doing and observed an hour of silence from 2 o'clock p.m. local time to mark the start of the conflict. Many in Sarajevo live daily with the memories of the longest siege in modern history. For 44 months, Belgrade-backed Bosnian Serbs shelled the town from the hills above the snipers and shot pedestrians at random. About 100,000 people were killed during the war, and half the population of 4.4 million fled their homes. While many of the city's most symbolic buildings have been restored in the years since the end of the war, Sarajevo still bears the traces of shells and bullets. The worst single atrocity during the war was at Srebrenica in the summer of 1995, when Bosnian Serb forces led by General Ratko Mladic overran a UN safe haven, killing about 8,000 Muslim men and boys. The Federation of Bosnian Serbs, Republika Srpska, and Muslim Croat Federation are still divided along ethnic lines, with a loosely connected government, an almost powerless central government loosely connecting them.
For more international news, we now go to headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. The Tuareg rebels in northern Mali declared independence today, taking advantage of extreme instability and political turmoil in the country. 2 weeks ago, the government was overthrown in a coup, partially in protest of how the then president was handling the fight with Tuareg rebels. The Tuareg are calling the new state Azawad. The EU and African Union say they do not recognize the new state. The U.S. military paper Stars and Stripes reports that the U.S. currently has a small number of troops in Mali as part of its AFRICOM mission. AFRICOM says the troops are acting in an advisory role. The number of dead in Syria continues to increase, even in the face of an international agreement in which the Syrian government committed to pulling back forces by early next week. International media report nearly 30 people were killed today. AFP says that tens of thousands of protesters were in the streets. Most of the deaths came in Homs and Aleppo. International leaders are still pushing Syria to meet the deadline, says Ahmad Fazi, spokesperson for the joint UN and Arab League envoy on Syria.
What we expect on the 10th of April is that the Syrian government will have completed the withdrawal of military units from populated centers, that it will have stopped moving any military units into cities, and that we begin a 48-hour period during which there will be a complete cessation of all forms of violence by all parties.
But despite all international efforts, the violence may be increasing. U.S. Ambassador Susan Rice spoke to reporters Thursday.
What we know, as opposed to what the government of Syria has said, is that yesterday, in fact, as in previous days, the violence has intensified. And our understanding is that yesterday was one of the more violent days of late in many of the Syrian cities of concern and in question.
In other news, thousands of Syrian refugees are pouring into Turkey despite efforts today to stem the flow. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports from Istanbul.
Reports put refugee numbers as high as 2,800 people fleeing across the border on Thursday alone. A foreign ministry official told FSRN huge numbers continue to seek refuge in camps run by Turkish authorities and the Red Crescent. A camp resident told FSRN that many in the recent wave of refugees are from the city of Aleppo. The Turkish government plans to consolidate the camps into a single settlement near the city of Kilis. One Turkish official told media that Syrian troops were laying mines along the border, trying to stem the flow of refugees from the country. Last weekend, a conference attended by 83 nations called on Syria's President Bashar al-Assad to stop the killing and negotiate a power transfer. Rebels from the Free Syrian Army and the Syrian National Council have been appealing for arms and direct military support. But so far, Western powers have shown little appetite for sending more weapons into the region. The UN estimates the Syrian uprising, which began about a year ago, has cost more than 9,000 human lives. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
The Bahraini blogger and daughter of famous activist Abdulhadi al-Khawaja has been arrested in protests demanding his release. Family members confirm Zainab al-Khawaja was taken into custody, and video posted on YouTube claiming to show the arrest depicts a woman passively resisting, her limp body being dragged into a white police van. The video shows an officer hitting her near the face at least once. Al-Khawaja's family has been outspoken in their criticism of Bahrain's government. Zainab's sister, Maryam, spoke to CNN about the situation in the country.
The reason why the oppression continues in Bahrain is because there have been no international consequences for their actions. So they have no incentive to change. Why would they change if there's no consequences?
Abdulhadi al-Khawaja has been in jail for nearly a year, serving a life sentence for his involvement in pro-democracy protests. He started a hunger strike on February 8th. This week, officials moved him to a military medical facility for treatment. According to the Bahrain Center for Human Rights, government officials told al-Khawaja's wife his pulse was so weak that he may go into cardiac arrest at any moment. Alabama Republicans, responsible for the state's controversial immigration law, have introduced a new bill that would revise portions of the original blocked by federal courts. Republican leadership says the changes do not shift the intention of the bill, but makes it easier for local officials to enforce. Local media report under the new legislation, some law enforcement powers would be expanded, but other sections of the law would more closely follow federal statutes. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
And thank you, as always, to Free Speech Radio News for those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at FSRN.org.
And that's our program for Friday, April 6, 2012. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows and interviews on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Nina Kurgia.
And I'm Claire Eagle. Today's show is produced by Chirag Mahajan. And from the entire news team here at CITR, thank you so much for listening.
Stay tuned for Stranded, right here on CITR 101.9 FM.